Today, we share with you our conversation with Chris Korbald, who we had the honor of speaking with in person at the 007 Science Inventing the World of James Bond exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago at the press tour. Well, there are some magicians that are really good at special effects, and Chris Korbald is one of the best of them.
Chris is great. He's worked on visual effects on 15 of the James Bond movies, many in a supervisory role. He's worked on Star Wars, The Dark Knight Trilogy, Superman, Inception, which got him an Academy Award, and many others. I mean, he's had an unbelievable career, and we got to talk to him.
Yeah. All right. This is Dan.
And Tom.
Of SpyMovieNavigator.com on our show, Cracking the Code of Spy Movies. Your spy movie team bringing you the best coverage of spy movies in the world for almost 5 years. All right. Let's take a listen to what Chris had to say.
It is our pleasure to talk to you, and I want to just start off with a compliment. The speech you gave in your acceptance speech at the Academy Award, I love the fact that you started off talking about your team, where they were, and because so many times people on stage don't do that. So talk a little bit about the team.
The team is what makes me look good, really. You know, ever since GoldenEye, I've had like a core team of about 40 guys, you know, and then we bring other specialists and other troops in when we need more, you know. Towards sort of like the second part of my career, you know, we were running at 100 crew most of the time. Because especially on bomb films where you could be preparing in three or four different countries, you were preparing in the States, in London, you were at vehicles possibly in a workshop that you were putting gadgets on, you know, so it was logistically, it was fairly quite difficult at times, but you know, we all pitch in on a you know, great set of guys who I delegate them to, and then they run with it. So teamwork is what it's all about, really. Teamwork and collaboration.
Right. So it's collaboration with the team doing the special effects, but you're also collaborating with the director and the writers. Because I remember hearing you talk about in GoldenEye how that tank scene wasn't supposed to be a tank scene.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I got called in to see Martin Campbell and Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson. They said to me, Chris, we're really worried about this motorcycle chase. You know, how can we make it better? I said, well, get rid of it. It's, you know, there's been three or four great motorcycle chases in the last 2 years. And they said, well, what can we do different? I said, well, James Bond starts that whole sequence in a military car park. Why didn't you just steal a tank? And they looked at me and said, yeah, great idea, but surely a car can outrun a tank. So I said, yeah, but a tank can take shortcuts like through buildings. So I think we can, you know, you have to have a logic, work out a logic in your, you know, if it's too outrageous, then the audience are not going to buy it. But I think we sold it just right that, yeah, the car could go around the block, but actually the tank just went straight into the middle of it.
Right.
So I firmly believe there has to be a logic to everything you do.
Well, and I appreciated it because I'm kind of tired of seeing motorcycle chases. So it was a great thing. Now, when you do a scene like that, most of that's done in studio. You know, you had a team go out and shoot some stuff in St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
Obviously, you didn't run a tank into the St. Petersburg post office like you did. So how do you decide what's going to be practical, what you can do on location, what you can do that you have to do in the studio? And when do you bring miniatures in?
Certainly on Bonds and working with Chris Nolan, we've always strived. And that's, I think, why I gravitated towards the Bond films and Chris, is that both entities always want to try and do as much in camera for real as possible, which works for me. And Chris and Barbara and Michael and Cubby gave me the encouragement, the confidence and the resources to do that, you know, which is not the case very often these days. So as far as what do we do, full size and miniature? Well, it might have been a miniature tank in the tunnel at the end where he fires out and hits the train, but the rest of it was all we took. I had to buy the tanks. And I bought the tanks in England. I had to go around. I bought three T-54 tanks, Russian T-54 tanks, that we modified and made them look like T-70 tanks, I think. But and the other thing that we did was that we bought an armoured car, which is a lot lighter. I mean, the tanks are 30 tons or something. We bought an armoured car, which was just 6 or 7 tons, and then we fitted dummy tracks to it. So we were worried that when we got out to St. Petersburg, the tracks were going to tear up all the ground.
Right.
So we had that option as a backup. But I never forget, the tanks were on their way out to Russia, and I had a panicky call from down at the docks, and a very panicky shipping guy said, Chris, we've got a problem. I said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, one of the tanks is still live. meaning that it could still fire a shell. So it's strictly forbidden. So I had to send two guys down there with a big billet of steel and get a guy from the Birmingham Proof House who licenses all the guns to go down and witness them welding this big billet of steel up the barrel. And then he gave a certificate to say it was deactivated. But the little curveballs that always catch you out. I never even thought about whether it could still fire a shell or not.
So now another scene that you did that you didn't do miniatures, again, I was surprised you didn't, was the train crash in Skyfall where it comes down in the subway.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you had to build two train cars.
Yeah.
How much lighter were they than the real thing?
They were a lot, considerably lighter. Okay. I tell you the backstory to that was that I was out in Los Angeles finishing off Dark Knight Rises, and I had a call from Sam Mendes. And Sam said, look, Chris, I've got this great underground foot chase, you know, through the undergrounds of London. He said, but I need one jaw-dropping moment. And I thought, well, let me think about it. And, you know, that night you sit down and your cogs start turning in your head. And I came up with the underground, tube trains are underground. Why, you know, let's blow a hole in it and one of brings one of its off its rails. And I pitched that to Sam the next day and he loved it. But and then I forgot about it really because I had another month to go on out in LA. And then I got back to London and I sat down with my team of engineers and one of them said to me, "What, Chris, what planet were you on when you thought that one up?" I said, "Well, we'll just go and get two out of service carriages and we can hang them and do the shot." And they said, "Chris, they are 70 tons each." Okay. All right. Well, we'll make our own. And the ones we made were 5 ton.
Okay.
So there's a big difference. Then the next question, I said, well, how long are these things? And they said, well, they're 80 foot long. So, okay. I mean, it's just banter really, you know, but you know, we made the two carriages and we put an overhead monorail in from one corner of the 007 stage to the other. So that literally it came across and it dropped into, you remember it sort of dropped
right in.
And one of the things I wanted to make sure was that, you know, rather than it just skid along the ground, I felt they should plough up the ground. So I worked very closely with the Art Department Construction and they built like a 12 inch deep floor that was soft. So we ploughed the carriages into that, which really, I think, sold it. You know, the ground was all ploughing up. So one of the things that we had to think about is, you know, we had two carriages, one total of 10 tons in total, coming in at 30 miles an hour. You've got to stop it. You know, you can't just stop it. So we had three or four different systems of stopping, you know, that once were magnets that clamped onto the overhead rail. There was three or four systems that all kicked in one after the other, slowed it down. But the end system was about 60 ton of sandbags that was just made a great big sandbag wall at the end to ever reach that. It just made it. So it just took the sting out of the tail in the sand at the end. But it was, you know, it was a one-off, really.
Right. So you also like to do explosions. And you do some pretty big explosions.
Yeah, to say I like doing explosions is not true. I have to do it. Well, I had to do explosions because it was part of the job. But, you know, there's so much testing involved. You know, the explosion that we did out in Morocco on the Spectre, you know, it was huge.
Right. And, you're in Guinness Book of World Records for that one. And then you usurped it.
So. Yes, yeah. I mean, those Guinness Book of Records give me nothing but grief because I knew that it wasn't my instigation. It was the production that jumped on it and said, oh, let's go to Guinness Book of Records. But I had so many people ringing me up saying, I did a bigger one than that. I did a bigger one than that. So, you know, it was a bit of a millstone around my neck, really. Just keep explaining. And I said, no, I don't care. I don't really need a Guinness Book of Records. It doesn't put any more money in my bank account. It was just a bit of fun, really. But, you know, I think the interesting thing about the one we did out in Morocco was that there was something like 300 different explosions that made up that big explosion. And we used a revolutionary new system where, you know, normally you have a stick of dynamite, stick a detonator in, you put 12 volts across the end and it goes bang. Well, because there were so many, we used these new state-of-the-art detonators, which are computerized detonators. So you programmed every single detonator to go off at a certain interval. So you say to that one, right, you go off at 2 seconds, you go off at 6 seconds, and you go off at 8 seconds. I mean, obviously, we're dealing in milliseconds with 300 of them, which is great because the system means you only have to run one wire and the whole thing, whereas normally you'd have to run a pair of wires to each individual explosion. So it made it easy to rig up. There's only one downside to that, is that as soon as you press the button, all the detonators all talk to each other and say, right, I'm ready, I'm ready, I'm ready. So there's a delay of 3 seconds from you pressing the button to the explosion going off. Now, the explosion had to go off in the very split second that Daniel said he'd finished his line. So I had to say to Daniel, look, no pressure, Daniel. I've got to press this 3 seconds before you finish your line, so don't mess your line up.
Yeah, this is one take.
Yeah, and he said, oh, you're shitting me, Chris. I said, no, I'm serious. But, yeah, we did loads of tests, you know. And he could get one line right. But, and it was great. I mean, they were the only cameras we had on it, that, you know, with Daniel and Leia in foreground, two cameras looking past them, you know, between them.
Right.
He finished the line, and then this whole eruption went off in the background.
Let's go home.
I mean, the great thing with that explosion, we were in the middle of the desert. Now, because historically, big explosions and glass don't go together really well.
Well, Thunderball, right? I mean, when they blew up Largo's boat.
Yeah.
Right? So
there was no glass in sight that we had to worry about breaking.
Okay. Now, let's fast forward to No Time to Die and not talk about the explosion. I want to talk about the donut scene. Because what you were just describing in terms of being able to wire those explosions, is that kind of the same technique you did for the things on the walls?
No, we didn't use that system there. And I tell you for why. We had to make sure they had a camera that looked along the side of the car. And if you remember, the shells were being ejected out of the side vent. And because they got that camera, we had to make sure that the squibs went off exactly when they were pointed at them.
Right.
So we devised a system where we divided it all up into 8 parts, and we had a separate firing box for each part. And then we would measure the amount of time. We had to get him up to speed going around, and then we would measure the total revolution.
Okay.
And then we divided that amount of time between those 8 boxes, which all had timers on. Mm-hmm. So that quadrant there, we knew that it had to take, let's say, 2 seconds to get from there to there. So we put all those squibs that were lined up with that dialed into the 2 second timer on the firing boxes.
Okay.
So, you know, because it would look strange if, you know, he's pointing over there, the squibs are going off over there.
Right.
So it took a little bit of time to work out, but it worked really well in the end.
Well, that's really cool. Now, these are big, big effects. Did you work on that cello case?
I did, yeah.
Can we go over there?
Yeah. I was part of a team that actually made this.
Okay, so Chris, we're standing in front of the cello case, right, from The Living Daylights, and this is one of my favorite James Bond gadgets ever, because it's such a practical device that has, when you look at it, there's no way this is a gadget, and you guys turned it into a gadget. Can you talk a little bit about how you did that and what made you think of it?
I think it was John Glenn's idea initially about the cello case, and it doesn't look like we're going in a straight line. So we had to work on how do we get in a straight line, how do we steer it, and it's really very basic. You know, you'll notice that there's two handles there and there, which literally you pull it up, it digs a little arm into the snow, and that takes you that way. And if you pull this one up, it takes you that way. But I don't think Merrim DeVoe was that impressed with this little sequence. It was the most uncomfortable ride. And, you know, we were putting squibs all down each side of them as they're going down. But I amazed at some of these ski guys. We had a cameraman skiing down backwards with a camera between his legs, these two acting.
Well, Willie Bogner started that on Her Majesty's Secret Service, that technique. Yeah.
But, I mean, quite extraordinary how they do it. You should stand there in awe.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
You know, I have trouble just skiing in a straight line downhill without going backwards and without holding a camera.
So this is more of a practical, you know, real-world kind of a feel gadget.
Yeah.
But you've also done some effects that have been kind of interesting to me, and things like in The Dark Knight, the semi-truck that does, you know, end over front of the truck, right? You do some of these explosions, and some of these things you're really doing. I mean, you filmed that in Chicago, didn't you?
I have a soft spot for Chicago because we filmed a huge part of both Batman Begins and Dark Knight in Chicago. Yeah. Chris Nolan had a soft spot for Chicago, and it kind of worked for Gotham City,
right?
And we built the Batmobiles in our workshops. Much to Chris's design, You know, he knew every single part of that car. You know, I never knew there were so many different shades of black. You know, him and Nathan Crowley were in there one day looking at 8 different blacks, and I said to my guys, what are they looking at? It's black. But they knew every part of it. So, you know, we had a great time. We were driving at 100 mile an hour with a Batmobile through Low Wacker Drive and flipping cars, and we had we flipped the truck
right
in LaSalle Street.
Yep.
The main banking district.
Yeah. Now, how did you pull that off and not, like, ruin LaSalle Street?
We didn't ruin LaSalle Street.
No, how did you not ruin LaSalle Street?
I tell you what happened. I mean, I wasn't convinced that we could do that. And I kept leaving it. And it wasn't going away, because sometimes you spend a lot of time losing sleep about how to do it. And then they write it out of the script. So I sort of tend to leave everything till nearly the last moment. But it wasn't going away. So I had the sort of design of the truck, and I thought, that's big. So the first thing I did, I went to Chris and said, look, can we, any chance we can make it, you know, not an 18-wheeler, maybe a 14-wheeler? And he said, nah, it won't look as good. So I went, okay. So I kept thinking about it. My next tactic was, well, do you mind if we just flip over the trailer unit and keep the tractor unit on the ground? Because that gave me a good hinge. Mm-hmm. No, it won't look quite right. I said, oh, okay. I'll be honest with you, Chris. I'm not too sure we can pull this off. I said, but what I'm going to do is we'll rig a truck, go down to the test site, and we'll try it. And if we succeed, then we'll go ahead with it. If not, we should maybe think about a miniature,
mm-hmm.
you know, because Chris likes miniatures.
Yeah.
So we rigged a truck. You know, I have two great guys called Dick and Lou. They're specialists at all this sort of thing, cannons coming out. We rigged the tractor unit. With so much steel in there to protect the driver. He was probably the safest person in the city that would do that. But and we went down there, we loaded up the big nitrogen cannon. I mean, it was a great big ram like that fired into the ground with thousands of pounds of nitrogen behind it. We cleared the site, started the guy off, the stunt guy, drove down the test site, pressed the button, and it just sailed over. Now, one of the genius things that the two guys did and rigged it is that they put two massive, great steel teeth out the front. So as soon as that back lifted, and bear in mind it was rigid, the whole thing was, there was no pivot in the middle. As soon as that thing lifted 2 inches off the ground, these great big teeth dug in the ground, and that gave us the pivot.
Okay, so you're tearing up LaSalle Street at that point.
Absolutely. Yeah, they weren't very big holes.
You couldn't do that in Materas.
No. But, you know, that was the success of it. You know, if it had gone up, it might have slid on its nose and mm-hmm. lost power. But right. The fact these guys put these two massive great teeth that dug into the ground, it gave us that.
It's kind of like ice skaters.
Hinge, yeah. Gave us a hinge. We knew where it was going.
Okay, cool.
It was a bit of a shock when Chris told me he wanted to do it in LaSalle Street. I was like, oh, come on, give us a break. You know, you got a chase man out and bank that side. You got some other bank that side. And there were, in actual fact, there was only two places in the whole of the South Street where we could do it, because I walked up South Street and there was a manhole cover there. There's another one there. And I said, can you get the local surveyor down? I need to find out what's underneath here. And he came down and he had this big map of there's a bank vault there. There's a services there. There's a drain there. And there was only two places in the whole street where there was a 20-yard area where there was nothing underneath. It was solid ground. There's something like 150 ton of power coming out of that big piston, so that mm-hmm. would have gone straight through the ground right. into a bank vault somewhere. So, but yeah, we pulled it off, and I lost a lot of sleep over that one, I gotta tell you.
I can imagine. Well, I want to not take any more of your time. I want to thank you for your time. You have no idea how excited I am that I got this opportunity to talk to you today.
I
love your work. I've been a big fan. So thank you very much.
Yeah, man, really, we want to thank Chris for that. It was fantastic talking to him and seeing him there live at the event.
It was
a lot of fun. I mean, the work that goes into the filming of the scenes that he's been involved in is just fantastical. And I'm saying fantastic.
That's a great word for that.
Yeah. I loved how he talked about the scene from No Time to Die in Matera, Italy, when he was filming the Aston Martin spinning and shooting scene, that one. There was an old church there that they could not damage, of course. So, of course, you know, it's hundreds and hundreds of years old. So the entire lower 3 feet of that church was a set piece. And that's where all the squibs that he was talking about were exploding when the Aston Martin was spinning and shooting. That's the magic in these movies. And that's the kind of stuff Chris and his engineers go figure out.
Well, and it's not just even that, but I mean, even the way he was talking about how they were getting it so the camera was aligned. Man, there's a lot of work that goes into this stuff.
Yeah, and then he talked about GoldenEye, you know, with the tank chase scene and how that came up. I mean, that was fantastic, too. He was like, we could have maybe him get a tank. What? Yeah, tank chase. Okay, yeah, that sounds cool. And then the subway train crash in Skyfall. Oh, man, that was great to hear how they did that. I mean, just super.
Well,
and talk with Chris Corbell.
Yeah, and us being in Chicago, yes, the Dark Knight is not a spy movie, but to hear him talk about that scene where that truck flipped over, because I know exactly where that is. If you grew up in Chicago like I did, you know where that scene was filmed, and him talking about them needing to hit the exact square, you know, like square foot where they could kick that thing off, or they'd go into a
bank
vault.
Right on LaSalle Street.
That was so cool. He was that's great to talk to.
The banking capital of Chicago on LaSalle Street there. So that's where all that was filmed. And he was such a gentleman to speak to. Very, very kind. We spoke to him for about 10 minutes really after the interview. And now we know he's focusing on directing and writing and so on. And that's what he wants to do for his next part of his life. And he made his debut, I think he said, as the second unit director on Skyfall, actually. And he did the same with other movies like Four Realms, Christopher Robin, and The Rhythm Section. The guy's unbelievable. He flew in from England for this event. And again, we were honored to speak with him. Thanks, Chris, again for spending some time with us. All the best with your writing and your directing. Fantastic.
Well, sometimes when we do these things, we use terms that are industry terms, and people may not know the difference between them. So why don't we end this, Dan, talking about defining some of these terms, because there's the visual effects, there's special effects. So
There's a big difference. Now, the difference between visual effects and special effects, and a lot of times you see them used interchangeably in articles and stuff, and they are not the same. And Chris was talking to us about this as well, off camera. And visual effects are post-production stuff, like CGI stuff, while special effects are done during production, like the car chases, explosions, crashes, and that kind of stuff. So there's a big difference. And the kind of stuff you're doing in filming, while you're filming the visual effects, that's what Chris is focused on. And that's where the engineering comes into place. That's where all the stuff he was talking about in the interview comes into play. All of that stuff that needs to be done while the camera is rolling. That's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. He was so nice to talk to, and he's so down to earth. And if you look at his background with the number of movies he's done, he's also been nominated 6 times for the Academy Award. He won for Inception, and he also had 11 nominations for BAFTA Awards, and he won 2 of those. So you take those awards that are in the movie industry, and in Great Britain, he was awarded an OBE, or the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. Now, here in the U.S., we don't really have a corollary type of an award, but in Great Britain, this is a big deal. This is a big award that your country has given to you. And we know about that because when we interviewed Julian Glover, that episode, he talked about the OBE and its importance, especially to a British citizen, to be able to be awarded that, and what a high honor that is. So we got to talk to this guy today, Chris Corbould, who's recognized by his country, recognized by his industry, and quite honestly, we movie fans recognize his work as well. That was awesome.
I don't think we can get any better than that.
Nope.
All right, that's a wrap. This has been Dan.
And Tom.
Of SpyMovieNavigator.com and our show, Cracking the Code of Spy Movies. Subscribe to our show in your favorite podcast app and to our YouTube channel as well. Lots of fun stuff there. Thanks for listening. We appreciate you spending time with us.